My friend Dent Gitchell, PhD, an educator, author, and meditation teacher in Arkansas, joins me today to bring a different perspective on reincarnation cases. After a childhood of being open to the unseen aspects of reality, Dent trained with Roger Wolger, a pioneer in past life regression therapy, which helps people recover from previous life traumas that are holding them back from healing and freedom in this life. Now, I'm not sure that all memories that come up in this form of therapy refer to actual previous lives, but many people find tremendous healing from it, and as you'll hear, Dent found it very helpful. This conversation also makes some connections between Buddhist teachings on karma and the previous lives Dent experienced. To learn more about Dent, to find his book, and to learn more about the psychotherapy he offers, check out his website, which you can find in the show notes. You can also find a link to my free courses on Buddhism.
So what's the backstory of your whole experience with, like, these previous life regressions?
I met this person named Roger Wolger, W-O-O-L-G-E-R, in 1999. And he had this process he did called past life regression therapy. He changed the name several times, but that was what it was called at the time, I believe. And I was referred to him by a professor of mine, Dr. Paula Englander Golden, who was a very interesting woman and opened me to a lot of things. And I guess there's a backstory in the sense that, I guess as a kid, I had a lot of, not a lot, but this sort of sense that the world was bigger and scarier than sort of culture around me told me that it was, or something like that. Mm-hmm. I grew up in my great grandfather's house that they built. I was sure there were ghosts in the house, which I kind of had verification of in a certain sense, which I can bring in. And I remember being three at this, some sort of three or four, probably at some sort of like vacation Bible school, and having these, like, not experiences of Jesus, but like this sort of visceral sort of feeling that Jesus was talking to me or something in a four-year-old way that I never really processed till I was an adult because for various reasons. And I was very in tune with, like, my ancestral past. I grew up in Little Rock, where the first mayor had been my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. And I have people who do genealogy on both sides of my family, and a lot of my family, basically the way the United States developed, we took over land and forced the natives out, and then white people immediately came in through all these acts and land grants and stuff. And my family were many of those people who came into Arkansas in the 1820s and 30s. So my mom would take me to these little cemeteries all over Arkansas and find these gravestones from 1860 and stuff. So I was very haunted almost by this sort of sense of past. And in my house, I remember laying there as a kid thinking, you know, my great grandfather lived here, and he was still alive. I would go visit him, and he would tell me stories of, he was the only branch of my family that came from the north, and he would tell me stories of growing up in Michigan and stories of Native Americans camping on their land. So I was just sort of aware that there was this big world that was much larger than my sort of little life. In my room, I was certain there was a ghost upstairs in the attic. My room had a stairwell to the attic, and I was certain. And
what made you certain? Like, did you?
I don't know. This was like 7, 8 years old, or this was my room growing up. I don't know. It was just more of a feeling that there was a presence there.
Whoa!
And maybe some noises sometimes. I'll kind of move ahead. There was a particular experience I had, like 21, where there was definitely some sort of supernatural entity in the house, and I can explain that story in a little bit more. But anyhow, so I had this childhood sort of thing about the past, that there were, like, almost like presences of these ancestral, not like they were talking to me, but this sense of that I was, like, somehow walking in the steps others.
Was that, like, ancestor related or, like, not ancestor?
Yeah, at this point it would be more related to ancestors, I think. And then there's this other sort of ghost experience that, I mean, I was frightened to be in my room by myself. And even like as a teenager, I remember being frightened, just kind of spooked. And, yeah, and then in my teenage years, you know, I experimented with like substances, et cetera. And we used to, my friends and I sometimes, we'd do psychedelics sometimes. Go hang out in graveyards.
Oh, man.
And,
that's awesome.
And there was this place that was supposedly haunted, and we would go look for this light. And I don't know, we would say we saw it. I'm not ever sure. But there was this sense of, like, looking for the mysterious.
Yeah.
So I was kind of looking. So when I was 18, I went off to Columbia University in New York City. And that's when I was kind of having sort of psychedelic experiences. And then my world was totally expanding, like, culturally, with meeting people from all over the world. And then I was taking this philosophy class with this guy named Arthur Danto, who was this old guy with a gray beard. I later came to find out he was like a famous philosopher. He was like at one point the president of the American Philosophical. But anyhow, he was teaching us about it was some sort of overview of Western philosophy or something, like for freshmen, not philosophy majors. But he did this stuff about Plato in the cave, and there's this study. In some of Plato's dialogues, migration of souls.
Mm-hmm.
And in the cave, my mind was just being just blown apart, basically. And I found a poem I wrote when I was 18. This is before I had any exposure to Buddhism or anything. I used to like to walk around New York City, and this isn't good poetry, by the way. This is like my 18-year-old self.
Yeah.
I saw a beggar on the street and looked into his eyes. I knew that in another life I was he in disguise. Existence is forever. Existence is me.
Wow. Like, had you been... Oh, sorry.
One more verse. I took a dollar from my pocket and put it in his hand. Again, it's not good poetry. I knew that in another life I had been a poor, poor man.
Hmm.
Existence is forever. Existence is me. And there are other verses on there, but they're all sort of this sort of past life sort of theme. And I don't know where that came from, really, honestly. And so,
like, so you hadn't been exposed to it before college. Like, this was a new.
No, idea and it, for you. Looking back on it, all I can think of in terms of exposure would have been this little, it was like overview of philosophy class, and maybe it was mentioned in the Platonic dialogues or something. But
mm-hmm.
This wasn't an in-depth philosophy class where we were getting into the dialogues. So I really honestly don't know. But there was just a sense of the world was bigger than myself and. Past lives and ancestral lives, maybe couldn't articulate it, but and then a lot of that probably got buried just from the culture I was living in, but it was kind of always there.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered Buddhism and read a bunch of books basically in my 20s, took classes, but read a lot of books, and that's when I became exposed to more traditional or more formulaic notions of past lives.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, I didn't really wasn't relating my past experiences. Though I had past life experiences, it was more like, wow, this might be true. It was more like just exposure to a whole new belief system or worldview. And move forward. I was in 1998. I was in a master's program in philosophy at University of North Texas, and philosophy wasn't my thing at all. I figured out at that time that I didn't. As a career.
Mm-hmm.
And I met this woman, Dr. Paula Englander Golden, who taught in the addiction studies department. I don't know how I came across her, but what she really taught was Virginia Satir, who was a therapist, this family dynamic stuff. But she had been off studying Hinduism and stuff in past life, so she really was doing her own thing and bringing all this into classes. And she's just doing this wild healing stuff. She was a healer. She's still alive, by the way. She was in Austin. She must be close to 90. I've corresponded with her a little bit. And it was like the first sort of main, quote unquote, mainstream person that I'd met that was like, I could talk about things like psychedelics, the Grateful Dead, these sort of past, just any Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, I mean, there's a lot of stigma in academia or in my social world, at least growing up in the South. And she just did this amazing healing work using the body and family systems and would bring in the stuff from Hinduism. And it was amazing stuff. And she was sort of my mentor. And she at one time said, you've got to come to this workshop. This guy's coming to town called Roger Wolger. I've been doing stuff with him. And so I signed up for this weekend workshop. And it was basically, it was either called past life regression therapy or integral regression therapy. It went through like three or four names, but it was past life regression therapy. And he had written a book called Many Selves, Many Lives, I believe. And I'd done a little bit of therapy as a client with a Jungian analyst. So I was pretty in tune with like this idea of multiple sort of personalities, for lack of a better term, or sort of multiple realities. And, yeah, so it was a weekend of regression therapy where we paired up and he did regressions and I had a private session with him at Paula Sal's. She arranged for that. And I was, you know, highly skeptical, like, it won't work for me kind of thing. And, I mean, with him, it just took me right into a regression. And I have to say that this particular way, it's not a reading. It's not like they're sitting somewhere and they're telling you your past lives. But it's very much a embodied experience that you go through.
Mm.
And I don't know if people are doing it anymore. I've looked around on Google. It was just amazing stuff. He passed away. I found a tribute to him. He passed away maybe 10 years ago. And anyhow, I went to this workshop and then I was like, this is my like calling kind of thing. I mean, I just felt like it was like amazing and healing. And so
yeah.
He had this training program. So I went to two or three week-length workshops in different places in the country and sort of at some point disengaged for financial reasons, or I can't remember if he changed his name, but anyhow, but it was like a really formulative period of my life.
Mm.
And I carried it with me. I've carried it with me since then, you know, like, what does this all mean? And so that's sort of the entry into how I got into it. And, then there are the actual experiences I had primarily with him and Paula and others. And we pair often and then witnessing other people going through regressions. So my very first one with Roger, the way he had, it's called induction methods. He stumbled onto this in his Jungian therapy. And apparently got ostracized by the Jung sort of, community at the time in the '80s. Sort of, he was very much a kind of this maverick guy who was like, I don't know what his background was, that he would get on the ground with people and do this kind of shamanic things and releasing burdens and releasing souls. And then sometimes there were spirit attachments as well as past lives. And I had one of those as well, which relates back to my ancestral things I brought up earlier. It was my great grandfather who was attached and he released that. But my first experience with him is, well, anyhow, he had several ways of inducing. One would be just kind of free
association,
just thinking of places in the world that you either like, wow, I just really resonate with it. Places and or time periods, or places that were like, whoa, you know, I don't like have a freaky feeling about. And it's similar to there's a mode of therapy now, integral or internal family systems. And I don't like that name, but it's basically, we have a lot of sub-personalities within us.
Mm.
And the ones that emerge are kind of the ones that need healing, maybe, something like that. So Roger was very therapeutic in his approach. But that was one way of inducing.
Wait, sorry. Said something really interesting to me, and I want to circle back later to it, but you said he's very therapeutic in his approach. So just to clarify, are you basically saying, like, he's more interested in the person healing than in, like, retrieving facts? Or is it just,
It's not a game, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a clinical, and he wasn't really interested in taking you through all the details of a life, but more traumatic parts of a life, or the parts that we need to learn from in this life. So his idea was that these lives emerge because there's something unhealed or that needs healing that we're carrying with this. So his overall approach was clinical and therapeutic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he would back away if people were fascinated by it and wanted to explore all these details of the daily life. But this embodied sort of approach, you're really sort of in the life. And it's not like you're sort of seeing it over there. It's very, at least my experience, was very physical and visceral.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very much interested in the healing. And he really beat that into us. And this has been 20-something years, but it was very, it wasn't like a mind trip. It wasn't an entertainment thing.
Yeah.
And he was very sensitive to sort of the energy and the, you know, when you're dealing with possibly spirits and past lives and things, just very sensitive to the specialness of it. That's not the correct term, but it should be handled gently, mm-hmm. professionally, and, mm-hmm. and the idea was to help people heal.
Yeah.
It wasn't entertainment. So yeah. He wouldn't entertain questions about, you know, oh, can you go more, you know, it was all about healing, basically.
Yeah. I love this. You also said something really interesting, you know, that it was sort of shamanic. I love that, you know, the integration of, like, I mean, shamanism was all about healing, you know? So I love the integration of these older healing modalities into, like, this, you know, sort of, like, modern therapeutic approach.
And I don't know Roger's training specifically, other than, apart from the, but he definitely had some training in shamanism. He had his own teachers. I mean, we'd get on the floor with people and, like, work magic like a healer can, you know, but you can't really teach people.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would talk a lot about the Tibetan bardos.
Oh, wow.
Things
like
that.
States of transition between death and rebirth.
And particularly in the spirit release aspect of his work, it was, you know, helping transitions through the bardo. He just had this wild sort of array of skills and worldviews he was bringing into his work. That I'm not sure where it all came from, but it was very authentic, and you know, they just naturally emerged through his own experiences, or, you know, he was specifically trained in different modalities.
It seems to me, I mean, I've had this thought so many times, you know, being interested in, like, death and transitions and stuff like that, like, exactly what you're describing is, like, exactly the skill set that we don't have access to as Western people, and most of us. I mean, unless we're fortunate enough to know someone like that who has those, like, shamanic type skills, it's like, it's a whole, like, technology of the mind that we just seem to have lost, or, you know, lost contact with, and it's so valuable. I don't know. It seems, from the stories I've heard and from my own personal experience, it seems so valuable.
And as we're talking, I'm just remembering these things in his training, and one of his sort of beliefs or emphases was we sort of have something to learn in each of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole life can be sort of, in a sense, condensed to, like, a single learning.
Mm.
And these traumatic lives often were, like, there's a sense of regret or shame or something at the dying experience, in a sense of, like, that lesson hasn't been learned or something.
Yeah.
So these sort of regret sort of get passed on to us as trauma or karma, how, whatever word you might want to use. It's a part of the healing process, is healing and healing the past lives. He would get down, we were trained to get down, and you relive the past life or the traumatic event, and you're going through it again, and releasing what couldn't be released, or gaining what couldn't be gained. So you sort of, and Paula did the same thing in her family, Virginia Satir work. I did something called a family reconstruction with her, where you go through this whole family systems. I can't synthesize it in a minute, but you go through this whole sort of, for me, traumatic event, and then you go through it again through this new lens of the present, and so in a sense you're reliving it but releasing the trauma.
Yeah. Wow.
And
this,
that was
powerful.
His perspective with past lives. So he was very skeptical of, you know, people whose all their past life experiences are positive kind of thing.
Yeah.
He would say that's kind of, we might call that spiritual bypassing or something now, or
mm-hmm.
I don't know if he used the word then, or disassociation or something. So it was very embodied and visceral, and there was a sense of release when it's like you're releasing something that you've been carrying as a burden, really, from this sort of past life that ended traumatically, or it wasn't released, or I don't know how you'd say that. So to me, I relate that back to karma, and in this internal family systems I mentioned earlier, they talk about intergenerational burdens and burdens we have in this life. So I just, to me, it's an easy extension that we have these burdens from our past lives, if they exist. And that's another thing we can talk about. I'm convinced they do. The framework for what that means, you know, I talk to these guys, but for me, I'm personally 100% sure that there are lives.
Yeah.
Or that we all have.
I'd like to dive into that. I know I kind of interrupted the flow of your narrative, we can come back to it, but I'm super interested to hear your thoughts on, you know, why you think past lives exist. But I'm also fine with coming back to that after you've kind of finished the arc of your story.
Well, I feel like in a certain way, I feel like I don't have the empirical verification. Well, one, I have a lot of respect for people who claim that past lives exist.
Yeah.
Just like I feel like they're not necessarily lying. I mean, yeah. The people I trust. And the experiences I had were so visceral and so bodily and so detailed. And the things I witnessed, both in leading others and watching others lead others, they couldn't have been reconstructed from memory.
Hmm.
Or even imagination, almost. It's not like I can't pinpoint to one sort of incident and say, like, this proves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the whole experience and my own experiences and watching others. In my study of Buddhism, I just came to a point where I can't not believe it.
Yeah.
I guess, personally. I'm not saying I walked in my life like fully, like, you know, I still have cultural and other reasons that probably prevent me from really taking that worldview to the extent it could. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, I'm like, yeah, I believe that wholeheartedly, 100%. And I've sort of carried that with me a long time. Like, what do you do with that when you, like, how do I teach my kids? And I've mentioned this stuff with my children and very cautiously, you know, in a culture that not only necessarily didn't believe that, but possibly like you could be stigmatized and that kind of thing. So I've always carried it cautiously. And I'm also very sensitive to people who talk, including myself, talking about things for our own self-gratification or something.
Yeah.
I don't want to be like, oh, I had all these past life experiences.
Yeah, look at me.
And at one point I talked to a Buddhist, I won't say his name, a sort of well-known Buddhist person who writes books and stuff. He was giving a workshop, and I managed to schedule a meeting with him. This is when I was in that training program with Roger. Just asked, you know, is this worth doing? And he was like, oh, yeah, it's great, as long as your purpose is to help people. And I was like, oh, okay. This is very I took that as a green light not to talk about it. But, you know, I wasn't sure. Is this something that even should be pursued? And I haven't spent a lot of time since then. I don't sit around and, like, journal or really think a lot about my past lives, or I've thought about it, but I haven't, like, done it and, like, tried to retrieve more, that kind of thing.
And there is a general sense with Buddhists sometimes that, like, you know, we tend to get stuck on past lives, and they're like, no, think about your future life.
It is
common in Buddhist circles to kind of almost downplay previous life memories.
Yeah.
But then also they totally believe in it. So it's not like they need, you know, I think for us to have those memories blows our minds open and, you know, it can shift us to feeling like, oh, yeah, okay, there are future lives, there are past lives. Whereas for them, it's like, well,
exactly.
Of course.
And I had one other experience now. I'm just thinking about it at a Grateful Dead concert in 1988, where I took too much of a particular psychedelic and just like was really out there. And then there was this moment like when the Grateful Dead come on stage, and there was like this burst of energy, and I had this like vision of being on this sort of rolling hill, and they were like, here he's coming, and it was Jesus.
Whoa.
And I don't know if it was a past life experience, but it was just like this visceral, like, and a lot of hippies kind of dress kind of like I would think that it would have dressed in Palestine.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of like this is happening, but like this other thing was really real. It was just a flash for like 15 seconds, and it freaked me out, and I ended up like in this tent where they help people who got too high.
The psychedelic first aid tent.
In that culture, there were lots of beliefs floating around, so the past lives and other things were kind of on the periphery. So I was sort of embedded in a culture where it was open to possible things.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, through more formal study and primarily through the working with Roger, I became a, that led to the experience with him.
Wow. So, I mean, would this be a good time to talk about the content of those experiences? Like, do you feel like sharing some of what came up?
Yeah, sure. I don't mind at all. And I've been looking for my old notebooks and 20 years ago, and I have like 3 offices, and I don't know if they even exist with all my moves.
Yeah.
So I've been sort of meditating all week, and the ones that have come to this, and most of these are things that have been with me, you know, they come to mind a lot over the years because most of them hit on certain themes that I still like struggle with or what have you most of the past life. The first one I did with him, I remember very, it was just me and him, Roger, and he's you sort of, through the induction, then suddenly you're sort of in a scene. And then sometimes the scene itself is what sort of the charged event, and other times not. So he'll just sort of lead you through, okay, they'll sort of dig around, and it's like, all right, it seems like a normal day. Can you move ahead in your life? And I should say something about this type of work. It's not hypnosis. He was very skeptical of hypnotic types of approaches. So it's like, it's similar to like working with trauma and therapy. It's like you're reliving it, and you're totally there, but you're also being guided, and you're aware that you're aware of your current self as well. It's not like you're in a, in a hypnosis or a state. I mean, so you can be led and that kind of thing, and have discussions and things. I remember walking down a path, and I'm guessing it feels like it was late 19th or early 20th century, and I always felt it was on the western coast of England or perhaps Ireland, but I felt England, like on a cliff, and there was some sort of metal structure, and I was climbing up it. I was a worker of some sort. It was like, I don't know what it was, like a thing that collects water maybe, or a windmill. That part's not clear, but I was up there and I fell, and I probably had a broken back because I was just laying there on the beach. And so that particular death, it was just a process of really going through the dying. And the fear just of being alone. And then that particular death, like, and he was really big on the dying thought. And it was just this simply regret of not being able to tell people that I love them and that kind of thing. So there was a sense of dying alone and not having any closure.
Man.
So most of these lives have a certain traumatic ending or traumatic event that I experienced, or I was thinking there was one that didn't, but that person ended up being burned to death.
That sounds traumatic.
I remember that. Anyhow, we'll get to that one. So that was my first exposure. So, and again, some of them had more detail than others. This particular one, there wasn't, had no details of the life as a whole, other than I know I was a male, and I was doing some sort of vocational work where I had to climb something. And I know it was like whenever late enough in history where they had iron structures or metal structures, it just felt very probably pre-automobile, but that kind of thing. And that was the one that really opened my eyes, because I was like, this won't work. You know, I'd read books and stuff, and I'd kind of tried on my own even. At that time, I was really into like just stepping in and trying things, and it just took me right in. And I was like, wow. And it always leads to the question, when I was like, what more about that life? And he wasn't really interested. He really took you to what he felt was the healing, and then hour and a half or so of the session, and then there was processing about, you know, can you relate to this in your life, or this. It was very therapeutic in its approach. So in that particular life, and again, this is years ago, you know, the healing might have been, you know, just getting closure or connecting with people and because it could all end at any moment or something like that. But there was also this sense of, I'm laying here and there's no one to help me. And I also had all these sort of visions of being laying in a crib. And I didn't know this, but like literally 2 months ago, my mom told me that I was something called a blue baby in the late 60s. And they didn't at that time think mothers should hold their babies. And I laid in this crib for like 6 weeks, my mom told me. And with like no like physical, or very limited physical contact and that kind of thing. So,
oh my gosh.
So when she told me that, I immediately thought of this past life. So, do you want me to kind of go through some others? I have a list here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just so interesting to hear like actual stories from someone. And then also, you know, okay, how does that relate to this life? I mean, I think that's the part that's like missing sometimes.
Yeah. And that was Roger's whole intent, you know, it's about healing, healing this life. And he told a story, for instance, the guy who ran all the time, like as a marathon runner type thing. And then he had a past life of some sort of trauma that involved having to run all the time. So there are various ways in it. And often the past lives would, this insight into a behavior we have that's compulsive or repetitive or that kind of thing in this life. Can't read my own writing. Well, I had one. Oh, good. One that was very vivid is I was a playwright in Renaissance England. And I really thought I was going to be successful. I was good. I thought I was good, but my work never was recognized. And I was extremely jealous of the person. I think it was possibly Shakespeare, but I don't know, you know, in my mind. This is the one that I tried to go back and on Google or whatever for a few hours every few years. I'll think about it. And at one point I traced it to a person who could have possibly been this person, but, I was just eat up with resentment that this person is getting all this attention and this fame, and here I am, I can't pay the bills, and I'm underappreciated. And again, these tie into like themes in my life. And I had this wife who I felt was just always nagging me about money. And one day I killed her.
Oh man!
With an iron skillet, and. In that particular life, I ended up in jail. It was like a tower. I think possibly a tower. It feels weird talking about this stuff
because
I'm skeptical of other people. I'm pretty sure it was the Tower of London, and I think I was hanged in that life.
Oh, man.
But, I ended up being killed or spending the rest of my life in a dungeon, or I don't remember which. But so, yeah, there's a sense of, in that life of being totally eat up with resentment. And sort of blaming all my mishaps on others, whether it be the culture or my wife or what have you. And again, it's very visceral.
Not particularly glamorous.
Like, he took me through the like killing her and stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, so it's something you really want to have the support if you're going to do this kind of work, I think.
Yeah.
I had another one where I was a Roman infantryman, I guess, but like, I don't know the technical terms. And it was just this feeling of just marching all the time and carrying stuff and just being like, just my life. I have no control over my life. I'm just a pawn. And I died in battle there. It was just this meaningless life, basically, this sense of life is meaningless. And, I have no control over my life. I'm just a pawn for whoever, the emperor, the army, or what have you. And again, each of these involved going through the sort of trauma and processing it in this life and releasing or learning from it, etc. But it did open my eyes at that age of, oh, wow, you know, these are like, seeing my complexes, for lack of a better term, or my problems as bigger than just my little life.
Mm-hmm.
which helped, because you start thinking, man, my parents were pretty good, you know, like,
yeah, right. Why am I like this?
Where do these neuroses, like, why am I like this?
Yeah.
And then that's why I tied it back to the ancestral stuff as well. There seemed like there was just growing sense that, okay, I've inherited a bunch of stuff. It's not necessarily pleasing, but it's pleasurable, but it's real.
Yeah.
And which ultimately relates to the question of, like, how real were these or not. I'd love to get into that a little bit.
Yeah.
Another, I was a female healer of some sort in France, and I've always had, like, this, like, if you list, like, what are three or four places, like, you're really attracted to, you know, mine were always India and France from when I was a small child. I didn't have any past life experiences of India, but I remember there was a cartoon out, Rikki Tikki Tavi, about a mongoose, when I was like 3 or 4, and I told my mom, I'm going there.
Wow.
Like, in India, but I never, anyhow. And I've always been like that about France. I'm reading it up. Like the Beguines right now, who were a religious order in the 12th and 13th century, I believe. And I was some sort of female healer. And I don't remember. I remember the past life was peaceful. And I was in the woods somewhere, and people would come see me for counsel. There wasn't a lot of details of what I was teaching or whether it was under the context of Christianity or not. I don't, even the time frame, but it seemed like it was medieval France at some point. And I, one of my lives I was burned to death. I'm pretty sure it was that one.
I was just wondering, like, that one sounds pretty good so far. Where's the trauma? Oof.
And then they weren't always trauma. Sometimes it was also like a strength or a capacity that could show up. So I could be mixing that up with another life where I was burned, but I'm looking through my life, but I remember that would have been it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also have this sort of fear of persecution in this life that, I don't know, I live in the South and the Bible Belt and all that, but, you know, that's sometimes way bigger than the circumstances which dictate, which leads to another life. Of I was an Islamic cleric or teacher of some sort, taught really like good stuff, similar to this woman. It was very heart-centered sort of teachings. And I ended up in some tower similar to the Tower of London. I think this was Baghdad, I'm not positive.
Oh wow.
And was stoned to death.
Ooh.
And I remember in that life the whole thing surprised me. Even when I was locked up, you know, I just thought, you know, I'm a pure authentic person. Like, they'll let me go, you know?
Yeah, then, yeah. Why would they do this?
And again, you sort of go through the trauma of being stoned to death or being hung or being burned.
Oof.
And I have another one that just flashed in as we were talking. I think it's a World War I pilot and going down with a plane. And that's one that I didn't do with Roger, but it just sort of has always been there. You know, I don't know if it's true or not, but I have an intense fear of flying.
Yeah, I bet.
So I don't know, you know, that could just be projection based off of that. And then the one that really sticks with me over the years is being a Vietnamese girl, and my village had just been bombed, probably by the Americans, I'm not sure, and running it with terror down the village path, or I don't want to say street, because it was dirt.
Mm-hmm.
My parents, you know, it was just sheer terror.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think I died soon after in that one, but it was just this sense of Jesus. You know, just if these are linear, I would think that would be prior to this life, or maybe prior to, I mean, pretty. I was born in 1967. And I don't know if there's a correlation, but as a kid, I was very different from other boys. I didn't like to kill anything, and I would just be freaked out, even like putting a worm on a hook and things. And I don't necessarily correlate that with that life, but those experiences opened up me up to, all right, there's these sort of patterns we have, or temperaments that can't really be explained through our parents and our family, at least to me. So those are the main like ones that I really went through in a regression that I can recall, and there are others that are more flashes or that kind of thing. But yeah, they all involved the trauma and certain themes. And Roger would say, like, what is the dying thought? And his idea was that thought was like sort of the karma that got embedded or passed on. And then one other experience I had with, and I've been trying to remember the context, but he would distinguish like what is a past life and what he would call spirit attachment to these things called spirit releases. And I don't remember the context. I was in a regression, like somebody else was leading me. And then this voice came or something that wasn't a past life, or, and Roger came over and helped. And it was like my great grandfather, who's the house I grew up in.
That you felt was haunted.
And he did this whole thing of releasing the spirit to my great grandmother to be with her in this pure light realm. The above was this land of pure light. And he called her by name and worked with him and said, are you ready to go now? Lead Dent. And he said, yes. And always had this like family burden and, you know, whether it's real or not. But the other story that verified, when I was 21 or 22, I was in the house. For whatever reason, I'd come back to live with my dad for 6 months or a few months. I was like sort of this itinerant sort of lifestyle for a while. And I was in the house with another person, not my father. And there was this old pump organ in the house that had been in the family like 1920. I don't know. You pumped it with your feet, you know, and hung out and played it.
I'm not familiar, but I can imagine.
It's an organ like it makes the church organ sound. And you pumped it with your feet. And then you had different knobs you could pull in. I mean, nobody's really played it in my family, but it was there. And about 2 in the morning, sometime in the night, the organ was being played.
Oh, man.
And it was one of those things. I woke up and was like, no. And we both just sat up. I was with another person. And it lasted for a while, and then you could hear like creaks or footsteps or something. And I mean, I'm 100% sure there was not another person in the house. And I'm not sure I've ever told anyone this. So to me, all these experiences just have led me to believe 100% there's something bigger than our reality that we think. And I'm saying we very loosely, you know, as a culture or what have you. And, all these sort of past life experiences in my study of Buddhism, you know, I'm 100%. I'm not 100% sure all these are necessarily 100% accurate, but I'm pretty tapped into the belief that, we come into this life with something. And then there's a question of, all right, are these just imagination? Or are past life linear? This is stuff I've thought about a lot. Or maybe there's just like memory bank. And if we're going through something, maybe we're tapping into a past life. You know, I don't know like what classical teaching saying, like reading the Buddha's story of this past life. It seems like, you know, these are my past lives, not yours kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I've played with ideas like what it means. I'm 100%, to me, I mean, I couldn't bear, I'm 100% sure that some of these experiences that I experienced and I saw others in regression are real memories. Whether they could be twisted to meet current needs or whether they're being pulled from some memory bank. Not linear, if that's making any sense. To me, those are sort of open-ended questions.
And it seems like that is a question, you know, often in the context of previous lives and previous life memories, you know, one of the explanations is, well, maybe people are tapping into, you know, just like the collective unconscious or something. And, you know, if you listen to stories of like children who remember previous lives, it really seems like there's an identification with a particular person, you know, which again, I mean, you could be choosing that because you resonate with their issues, but it does seem like there's some sense of continuity of identity.
Yeah.
And you know,
that's my belief. My belief is, mm-hmm. I mean, sort of thinks with Buddhist belief, I guess, that there's this continuity of identity and, I can't prove it, you know, so I'm open to other possibilities.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty certain myself, you know, it's not simply these acts of imagination or projection or what have you, that there's definitely, we definitely have what internal family systems we call subpersonalities.
Yeah.
Virginia Satir worked with, you know, what those are, you know, is an open question, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Where they come from.
Speaking of which, I'm kind of curious to hear more if you, I don't know, remember more, if there's more you feel like sharing about the idea of kind of, I forget the name, but like spirits kind of getting stuck onto you, or, you know, this ancestral stuff that may not even be ours from a previous life. Like
spirit, he called it, I think it was called spirit attachment. The process mm-hmm. was called spirit relief.
Mm.
And you know, this is a long time ago, so, but there was this notion that, and I think I've maybe read this in Buddhism, like he would say our head chakra is like wide open as a kid or something.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And then he had tied these spirits to kind of like the hungry ghost
mm-hmm.
in Buddhism, and that this sort of, they're so attached to this world, they're sort of roaming around and he said kids are wide open.
Mm.
And that they'll come and attach. Mm-hmm. Not like literally, but you know, the energy system's open and not protected.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll attach typically to a child between, he had certain ages even, he would say that, that were most susceptible to it. And that really rang true for me. I grew up in that house, and my great grandfather moved out of the house. My great grandmother died first. I barely remember her. I just remember her feet. But I would go walk up, he moved like a block away, and I would walk up and talk to him.
Mm.
Had a real special relationship. I still remember the way he smelled. And, you know, he'd tell me these stories from growing up in the 1800s in Michigan, and he came to Arkansas. He was an orphan and came there, I don't know, like 13 or something. Back then, when you're 13, you're on your own, and somehow he ended up in Little Rock. So it makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, yeah. And I always had this strong, like, burden almost that family history or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that made sense. So there's this idea of the spirit was actually attached to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't sound dissimilar, again, from a lot of, like, shamanic beliefs in different cultures, that there can be, like, a bit of, you know, someone else's intention or someone else's just energy that can get, you know, stuck to you.
Yeah.
Or, and that you can lose bits of your own energy to someone else, too, and need to reclaim that.
Wow. Okay, yeah. So it was a very healing experience, Marie, just letting that burden go and letting things go to this clear light where my great grandmother was.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was it was healing to him as well as to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's not a sense of like bad intention toward you, just almost, you know, just the caring that turns into stuckness.
Yeah. I'm doing work with my family's history as enslavers for persons who. Mm. And I do have a sense that some of those people are kind of pissed at me. I mean, I'm being honest. Like, there's a sense. There's a sense of Lama Rod Owens talks about this a little bit, working very carefully with ancestors. So I don't really do this work like deeply, but I've been going to graveyards and sort of having discussions with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, and being in Arkansas, there's a lot I can visit.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And just, this is like a felt sense. There's a feeling that most of them are on board, but there's some that are kind of not on board. And I'm kind of questioning whether I should even be saying this because this is like something current, but there's a real feeling that the ancestors are kind of present.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's not all like just well intentioned.
Yeah.
I don't have evidence for that. It's more of a feeling of caution, or there's certain energies there that aren't necessarily on board with sort of racial conciliation or what have you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's like a deep strand of white supremacy. Yeah, I felt something similar sometimes. Like, I remember driving through Mississippi to visit one of my friends from grad school, and just, there's just something that made me super uncomfortable going through certain places, and, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just me and my imagination, but I, you know, in all these different systems, you know, the Tibetan system or different shamanic systems, it's not just that everyone sort of in the non-physical world is out to help you. There's right. some folks who still have their own agenda and who, you know, are not on board with changes you might want to make, or, and some of them are just malicious or misguided or whatever.
Right. So I definitely believe in afterlife or bardos. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I necessarily technically believe in like the specific Tibetan version, like the mm-hmm. Book of the Dead, et cetera, but just, mm-hmm. there's something there, you know, and all these sort of systems and in my own experience that I have to feel the same way if I go up to the Delta or Arkansas Delta or Mississippi, you just, I can just feel that there's something alive there that's, that's still there.
Yeah.
Like the trauma is.
Yeah.
Not only the trauma in two ways, you know, persons who were victimized and persons who were in the system of perpetuating the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of that is there still. Mm-hmm. Or that's energy or spirits or what have you. I can't speak to that, but
yeah,
I can feel it.
Yeah. Just one more layer of like why it's difficult to make like structural changes.
Yeah.
Wow, it's just so much, you know. I feel like our sense of self often is like, it kind of stops at our skin, you know, like it's this very bounded thing. And it feels like, you know, you kind of started the conversation with saying you've always felt like there was something much bigger. And, you know, I think that's the more traditional way in like almost all human cultures of thinking of ourselves, you know, with all these different connections to previous lives and ancestors and, you know, it's not just me out for myself.
Right. Yeah, for me, it's been very helpful. The non-ancestral sort of past lives are non-ancestral parts of me. These come from non-ancestral lineages.
Mm-hmm.
It opened, you know, I probably had a lot of white guilt or something. I've been, for whatever reason, thinking about race since I was, like, a young child, talking to my mom about it and stuff. And, like, I'm more than that.
Yeah.
That's real. But there's also, and we all are, I mean, I guess. You know, we're all way more than our particular personal history, even our family history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I've thought a lot, you know, why are all my past life Europeans mainly. Others. Well, there was one in Iraq, or I don't know what it was called then, Islamic country. But that's, I think, just part of the healing that, because I witness others that, you know, past lives all over the place. All of one of hers was like a gazelle or something on the African savannah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and there is a tendency.
All of mine were like, pardon me, most of mine were like European within the past 300 to 400 to 500 years, if it wasn't. But that's, I don't know if that's normal or not.
Yeah, I mean, like, from the research that's been done, you know, people usually come back again into a familiar context. So, like, same family, or not very far geographically, or the same culture, even if it's spread out. And there are cases of people, you know, really coming from very different cultures, but they're much more rare. So it kind of makes sense that if that's been your recent context, it would kind of be, you know, yeah, it's not surprising to hear that, like, most of those lives have been in a European context.
Okay. And I have a sense of some sort of karmic, like, burden towards Tibetan Buddhism or some of the lineages. Mm. I can't pinpoint that. You know, it's not a memory, but it's more like there's a particular lineage I really gravitate towards and another that I, like, I don't know, there's a sense that there's something there other than
in this lifetime,
than just intellectual, like,
yeah,
I don't even know if I should say that, but there's a sense.
I have the same thing, just for the record.
Being attracted, and also like almost a sense I've done something wrong that I need to repay or something.
Mm.
And then others, it's like, oh, I was a bad student or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was a shitty student, and for some reason, you know, I didn't follow the teachings like I should have or something. And then sometimes there's this sense of, oh, I violated something, and you know, I don't know, like, what's my own personal issues now? But there's this,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting that even within lineages of, mm-hmm. of the religion or that Buddhism, you know, have different sort of energies that are sort of before I read books about it, it's like this certain, like,
mm-hmm.
really heart sense of, like, wanting to read more and more, and others, it's like, mm-hmm. whoa, like, there's maybe some fear there or something.
Yeah. For me, it's just like a sense of certain things are just so natural. It's just like kind of diving into the water. And with other things, it's like, I have to read this text, so I'm going to get through it. But, oh,
right. Right.
I don't want to.
So based on Roger's work, I really feel like we have periods of, there's something there.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just fascinated by like 12th to 14th century France. I just mm-hmm. can't read enough and get enough. Certain places in India, or I've never been to India, but it's just like it's just there in my heart, and other, you know, other places I have no interest in at all.
Yeah.
And others, maybe there's this, oh, this fear thing.
Yeah, that
makes, and it's hard to sort out, like, what comes from, you know, what comes from reading a book in first grade.
Yeah.
Or from seeing a cartoon or a movie, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so
it's hard to
sort out. I don't put too much stock into it. But my experiences lead me to believe that there's definitely something we come into the world with. That
mm-hmm.
there are all these energies around us.
Mm-hmm.
And within, like, us. Our life is kind of an interaction between these things we bring with us and these things we're interacting mm-hmm. with and being repulsed by or attracted towards. Or
mm-hmm.
And then we have these unhealed rules, but these are rigid sort of ways of acting or unhealed ways of coping or responding to the world that really, I feel like it needs to come into the world with a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddhists, I think, say, you know, we, in some ways, we choose our parents and all that. You know, I don't know. It seems like there's some truth to that.
Well, the Buddhist take is you're kind of karmically drawn to your parents.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. I think there's some folks who would say you know, work with spirit guides or whatever in between lifetimes, and you choose your life and you choose your parents.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find that overly optimistic.
Yeah, and Roger would say something like along the karma line, and we come here with this sort of, there's something that should be, like, there's a lesson to be learned in this life.
Mm-hmm.
A lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So that ties into the karma narrative to me, that we're sort of coming in,
mm-hmm.
being propelled, with choosing a life that in some ways, it's mind-boggling when I start to try to put it in words. You know, like,
yeah.
I don't want to say we all come here with a lesson to learn and grow and heal, because there's a lot of people who,
yeah,
whose lives don't really seem to go in that direction. So I don't want to be like,
yeah,
be very careful not to say we all come in with a lesson and it's great and we're moving because maybe we're all making spiritual progress, because it's way trickier than that, I believe.
I agree. I think that's part of, you know, the objection that I have to this idea that, like, everything that happens in your life is in your own best interest. Like, you know, I mean, how do you say that about the war in Syria or stuff like that? I mean,
right.
It seems,
yeah, exactly.
It seems more plausible to me that we come in and we have these things that are unfinished or, you know, karmically charged for us. And then when we find ourselves in that situation again, like, it's an opportunity to resolve it. But, like, honestly,
right.
You know, not everybody has the circumstances where they can resolve it, or the support, or, you know, whatever it takes in your life to do something different. It's a lot of, you know, energy that's required, I think, to do something different or to heal or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Man, this has been kind of mind-blowing and mind-opening, and I totally appreciate it. Do we address fully enough, like, the reasons that you feel like this is factual? Is there anything else that you want to add? I don't know if we, like, specifically dove in on that, but I feel like I've heard a lot of evidence.
In my own experiences, I don't have any past life I can, like, in the one of the books, I'm pardoning, there was somebody who was a tennis star, for instance, and they could, like, I don't have any of my life. I tried with the English playwright, and I think I got close, or it was a possible hit, mm-hmm. but I gave it up at some point. It's like, what's the point?
It doesn't, yeah.
It's not helping me
yeah.
be a better person or what have you.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, so I don't have any evidence like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to talk about other people's experiences because it feels kind of like invading them, but I saw some other regressions. It's just like being in the process,
mm-hmm.
opposed to someone leading the process, and mm-hmm. someone experiencing it. Yeah, I just have, it just came out of it with this belief, and mm-hmm. it's not something I could prove to you. That's really it.
Yeah. Yeah, and there has been a lot of, like, systematic research into it, you know? So for me, like, I find that pretty compelling evidence, you know, thousands of case studies and stuff like that. And yeah, you know, like, yeah, that definitely. Plus hearing your subjective side of it, of, like, it felt compelling, it felt like memories, even if they're filtered through this modern, you know, life that you're having.
And the memories are very detailed.
Mm.
Like, I'm not a visual person even, and I was skeptical I could, like in Tibetan types of meditation, I've always felt like I'm not doing it right because I never, you know, I can't generate the whatever.
Yeah.
But I was really surprised in this method. Like, for me, I mean, part of the induction is really asking persons to explain the details around them. And it's very, it was, in my experience, very vivid.
Mm-hmm.
You're in that world, and you can tell the person what you're seeing, what you're experiencing, what things smell like. It's very mm-hmm. visceral. So again, that doesn't prove.
Yeah.
But it's not like you're just having a sort of a vision or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very embodied and very visceral. Visceral is the word that keeps coming.
Mm-hmm.
Very sensual. Through the senses.
Mm-hmm.
And just doing it and experiencing it and seeing others do it and experience it at some point. And then reading Buddhism as well. People, you know, like the Dalai Lama, that I don't think are lying.
Yeah.
But then some of the classic Buddhist sort of, or the still use at least, are this sort of reflecting on the continuity of the mental continuum and things like that. That doesn't do it for me, really.
Yeah, those
sort of rational proofs or rational sort of arguments or discussions that are intended to, I mean, it makes sense to a certain point, but it's always like, yeah, but this sort of stuff combined with reading that kind
yeah.
of stuff, combined with just a fact,
yeah,
so much of Buddhism. And then that, and I think it's really interesting bringing that forward to Buddhist practices, for instance, the compassion practices. The famous, you know, 7-step compassion practice, you know, important step is one, all of the, even the 4 reflections, you know, it's a much different reflection. Karma is when you're bringing
yes.
in past and future lives.
Yes.
Or the precious opportunity of this life.
Yeah.
And I know there's quite a debate about that in more secular or context of teaching Buddhism to persons with a modern belief system.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that stuff is necessary. And in my own experience,
mm-hmm.
this sort of widening perspective is highly beneficial in those contexts of those meditations. But then mm-hmm. the question is, how do you, is that a necessary part of it? Or do you just let people, you know, I don't
yeah.
know that the answer there. But I remember studying that when I was first getting into that compassion step process of one just, well, the 4 thoughts that turn the mind that's embedded in there, but then that idea of, you know, seeing everyone as your mother and everyone as
yeah.
your mother in a past.
In a previous
that has
life.
A whole different, different ring to it. And I'm not saying I can just get there and say, oh, and totally get there. And this person who aggravates me was my mother. But it does soften the edges a bit. That's what I talk about when I teach it.
Yeah.
It makes you open to, and you meet people and you, there's sometimes an instant, you're instantly connected. Sometimes there's this.
Yeah. An instant disconnect.
And I'm not sure what I'm saying exactly, but the opening perspective tied into the practices that they're really embedded in, I think, add a lot to the practice. So part of my own interest is what, how effective are the practices when you pull them out of the belief system, which is part of this big wider discussion that's going on about, you know, the modern approach to these ancient practices. So I see a benefit, but at the same time, I feel like we're at a place where Western culture has had us all in a box.
Yeah. Yeah.
About what's real and what's not real. And now the box is being broken open and leaking in all different directions.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe not older people, but I think hopefully younger generations might be open to this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember asking my teacher when I first was doing these compassion meditations, I just wanted to share with others because I was like, this is the answer kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because I was working in helping professions, et cetera. And I remember having discussions like, is the reflection on past life necessary? And the answer was, well, yes, definitely. And so there's this, you know, this discussion of, or this, like, how effective can the practices be without this other worldview? And I'm on the fence, honestly. You know, I teach compassion in secular audiences, and I see the benefit. But I feel like that wider, I don't think it has to be like Tibetan system of past lives, but the wider framework is like supercharges the practices or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, how do you really, like, I teach my kids, you know, if you do the right thing, good things will happen. You know, I've always told them that. And I'm like, how do you really believe that if you don't? Shitty things happen.
Yes.
But that sort of belief is really embedded in a bigger belief system. And so part of my own thinking is how can we as a culture develop this wider perspective without, you know, mandating a particular religious perspective.
Yeah. Kind of, like, you know, I'm a big fan of Jeff Kripal, one of my professors in grad school, and he writes about the paranormal, you know, and he would put reincarnation, all this kind of stuff, like, in the category of the paranormal. Like, para in the sense of, like, it's just, it is normal, but it's not part of our reality yet. You know, it's not supernatural. It doesn't have to be religious. You know, like, there are cultures where it's just, it's like physics. I mean, nobody questions, like, if I throw this apple up, is it going to come back down? You know, like, do we have previous lives? Well, yeah, duh, obviously. And, you know, it just seems like to have that understanding of who we are and how we're connected, like, you can't go out and exploit the environment. You're going to be reborn into it. Like, global warming, I mean, I'm probably personally going to be dead before, like, the worst of it happens, but if I'm coming back, that is my problem.
Yeah, it just gives you a whole different perspective on things.
Yeah. You know, for me too, like, the teachings in Buddhism on karma, I would say I was, like, you know, agnostic about reincarnation until probably, like, 2008, 2009. So I'd already been Buddhist for, like, over 10 years. And there was something about, you know, reading Ian Stevenson's work and the research and just, you know, like, this flip in my mind happened where I was like, oh my God, wait a minute. Maybe this is actually, like, the most reasonable explanation for a lot of stuff in our world. And, like, I read Buddhist ethics completely differently. Like, even mindfulness in a traditional context, it's not just about, like, being in the moment. It's like, no, you want to be in the moment so you're not, like, harming yourself and others. So you're creating better future moments. Like, the whole system is oriented toward this, like, huge narrative arc of, like, past and future lives. And, like, it doesn't even make sense to say, you know, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings if I think that's only possible in this one lifetime. Like, I'm definitely, almost definitely going to fail at that this time. But, like, maybe I'll get closer. And then three lifetimes down the road, maybe I'll accomplish it. But, like, Yeah, I started out in the Dharma without any of that larger sense of context, and it's completely different, I think, to practice like that.
Yeah, to me, there's definitely a disconnect. Robert Thurman says basically that our culture teaches us that when you die, it's nothing. There's just nothingness.
Yeah.
And that's really embedded, and that's what most people implicitly sort of believe.
Yeah.
And then he points out how logically that's impossible, et cetera, you know, this Buddhist logic, but that's the belief that, like, we're something, but we're really nothing.
Exactly.
And if you believe that.
Exactly.
If that, and I believe we've all sort of, saying we, because I was loosely painting a picture, but many of us, we have implicitly sort of inherited that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, if I'm, and a lot of the logic and the practices of Buddhism don't work.
Yeah.
As effectively, because, yeah, it doesn't, it, whether it's belief in reincarnation or something larger, and I feel like we lost that in the West, but there's still, like, I've been reading 14th century, you know, Christianity recently, 14 and 15, and it's just, certain of their belief systems seem like really infantile now, or about, you know, some things. But in another way, they were just totally open to aspects of reality we've lost. And being in the South, in Arkansas, you know, there was still, like, some of it trickled down through folk folk religion and folk healing and all sorts of stories in the Ozarks about that it's gradually been, you know, sanitized away or explained. I don't know what I'm saying exactly, other than I feel like the sense of openness and mystery and interconnectedness is really important spiritually. And so hopefully talks like this and other things that are going on, I feel like we're right.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the next step we need to take.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I can believe in climate change and this and that, but, you know, I'm not going to be around. It's not that critical. But if I open myself up a little more, then it's really critical.
Yeah.
Just from was it Dalai Lama talking about wise selfishness? Just, I don't have to be, like, enlightened necessarily to really get a sense of urgency.
Exactly.
Or that person who aggravates me. You know, it's one thing to do meditations about them, just like me. But it's another thing to think, wow, you know, maybe this aggravation or this relationship is coming from somewhere that's much bigger than me and this other person.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't allow me to just open my heart and be there necessarily and love this person, but it softens the edges a little bit, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So that's one of my interests, is just, you know, to me, beliefs are meaningless unless they're going to impact our way we live and ethics. And so I'm a firm believer in the compassion practices, and I'm a firm believer that they get supercharged with the, it's not just, compassion is not just a feeling.
Yeah. You
know, there's a lot of wisdom or, from, like, the Buddhist uses that word. And that's coming out in the Christian mystics, I see, as well, those same concepts. Love is understanding and these sorts of things. And, where's I going with that? It's what we need. We need, as a globe, as a culture, what have you, a sense of responsibility, ethics, common humanity, or common, I don't know the word for it, outside of humans with animals, common life.
Yeah.
Life of the earth.
Yeah.
A sense of commonality, and we're all in this together. And to me, the reincarnation sort of framework does it. I don't think it's, like, the only way to get there.
Yeah. But it just opens that possibility, you know, this could have been me. Like, this could be me in a previous life. It could be me in a future life. You know, animals could have been me in a previous or future life. Like, there's nobody that we get to just completely cut off as not mattering because, you know, we're not like a completely separate form of existence from any living being. To me, that's part of what reincarnation says.
And then there's that first thought that's often the first one of the preciousness of human life.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a whole different...
Mm-hmm.
Just, oh my gosh, you know, especially tapping into all these traumatic lives.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want that again. I mean, just from a personal... your perspective or whatever you want to call it. I don't want that again.
Yeah.
And then there's this idea of, you know, what is it in the ocean, a small ring, and what are the chances that a turtle will come up? You know, that's sort of...
There's a classic story of, like, there's a golden yoke or something, like Y-O-K-E, like a little ring that floats on the oceans of the world, and every 100 years this blind turtle pops its head up, and the odds of the turtle popping its head up through that ring, that yoke, is like the same as us getting a human lifetime next time around. I'm not sure that's literally true, but like to have that sense of the preciousness is really valuable.
Right. So the preciousness to me is not only the human life, and a human life endowed with, you know, the 8 qualities or what have you, which just being able to sit here and have talks like this and study the Dharma, it really, if I'm really on my game and reflect, it's like really is a sense of urgency.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not simply, okay, but it's like urgent. Like, I don't want that again. I don't want that. You know, it's more than just for my children, but I don't, there's a sense of, you know, this is the time now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just super, every time I sort of, I'm having it in this talk, but every time my world opens, you know, I respect the teachings more because you can always go deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
So, yeah, anyhow.
Yeah, it really is like, oh my god, people spent centuries honing a system that tells you how to navigate, you know, past and future lives. It, like, it tells you how to navigate all these things that we don't even believe in. Like, we have no resources. Or at least I, growing up in a fundamentalist Christian sect and, like, with science as my background, I had zero resources for navigating this stuff. Right. But it's, like, the most important things in life. You know, how do you die? What's going to happen next? How do you try and set yourself up for a better, like, next life? Turns out there's a whole science of that. Like, it's amazing. It's mind-blowing.
And I do have to mention, I didn't mention this earlier, the whole Tulku phenomenon in Tibet.
Yeah.
It's not only what people say. I mean, I'm not going to mention teachers or specifically, but I mean, there's undisputable evidence that that has occurred and is occurring.
Yeah. I should just define the Tulku system, for those who are not familiar with the term, is when, a lama, like the Dalai Lama, you know, dies. The current Dalai Lama is the 14th in a reincarnating lineage. And when he, you know, when the previous Dalai Lama died, there was a search party, you know, they followed omens. They found potential kids who could be, you know, the next Dalai Lama. And then they actually did some tests, like taking items from the previous Dalai Lama, seeing if the children recognized them. And the one who was chosen, you know, he saw beads around someone's neck and grabbed them and was like, those are mine, give them back. And, you know, so it's like systematizing reincarnation. Like, how do you find these people again and again? And then once they're found, they're kind of, you know, taken to a monastery, they're enthroned, and they basically spend like their entire life, like being deeply trained in, you know, the Dharma and meditation and all this kind of stuff. So it's like they're creating like the super charged Dharma holders through this system. Sorry, I just wanted to explain that for people who aren't familiar.
Yeah, thanks. And without going into any of the stories or teachers, I mean, to me, there's evidence there that I 100% believe in. And that combined with the scientific stuff and my own experiences, and I forgot to add that piece in when I was talking about like why I 100% believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had something else that was right on my brain. It went away. It'll come back, I'm sure.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. I just figured people who weren't familiar might, like, lose the thread by the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This when you start believing or just considering the possibility of past lives and future lives, it just opens up the teachings more and more.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just teachings are embedded in a particular cultural perspective, so it'd be easy to say, all right, that's just culture and this is the authentic teaching.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do, but
it's not, and I used to think, you know, is this all just a mind trick or a mind game you're playing? You know, is it just, and it could be that sometimes, that there's something, it just, just when you start reflecting on the teaching in that way, it just puts a sense of urgency and a sense of interconnectedness, perhaps. Sense of gratitude, even, like, and the whole Bodhisattva, it puts that in a much wider understanding, and for me, sense of respect for this, just these few lives I've sort of discussed, and you just realize the immensity of suffering. And then you think that on humans have been here, what, 300,000 years, whatever, I don't know that.
Yeah.
And then that, and if you meditate on the suffering of life, and you meditate, one program where you're meditating is a fish, and it seemed like, oh, great. But when you really get in the fish, it's just pure terror of either being eaten all the time or trying to eat something else. And when you extend past lives into all that we've inherited, and then you think of the Bodhisattva resolve
to become awakened, like, and liberate all living beings.
Basically get out, right?
Yeah.
But they're choosing, they're saying, no, I will not get out until all sentient beings are liberated. And it seems like that's just kind of a words or a mind trick, but then you think Bodhisattva is much more realized than me, and I just sort of tapped into this stuff. If you really had a vision of the immensity of suffering, and yet are choosing to come back, it's almost mind-boggling in terms of the courage, the compassion, the confidence. So, yeah, I believe that we can just scratch the surface of the teachings, or are scratching the surface of the teachings.
Like, if you don't have that belief in reincarnation and past and future lives.
Just the immensity of the tradition and the immensity of the teachings just, to me, are just gradually open up more and more. And it's not simply, you know, doing meditations or reading. It becomes a worldview, you know, as your worldview expands, the teachings are like, oh, yeah, they were right about this. Or now I have a new understanding of this teaching that made no sense to me. Such as the preciousness of human life, or just, like, what does it mean to take the Bodhisattva vow, really? Or to read these prayers, when you start realizing the immensity of suffering, it's like, I think for me, at least, it should instill a little bit of terror in you, or, I don't know if terror is the right word. I don't say we get terrorized when we do practices, but it's just a sense of, oh my gosh, this is pretty big. These people that we're following, the example's pretty big.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's the same in Christianity, that when the Christian mystics I'm reading, you know, the stages of the path, they have a similar type of system in the sense of progression and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we've lost all of that, you know, just with science and our world, particular worldview, economics, et cetera, that people know about.
Yeah, and science and all that has brought us so much, but maybe there's a different way of relating to it where we don't have to lose so much too.
Right.
Man, this has been, I mean, again, like our previous conversation, I just feel like inspired, and, you know, my mind is cracked open, and it's just so cool to hear these stories from someone I know. Like, it's very different to read them.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. You know, my mind's cracked open. I'm seeing all my books they're behind me, and I'm like, oh, I need to go read those.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. Oh, I need to do an episode on this book and this book. And yeah. I need to do an episode on the Tulku system. That'd be, I think, really interesting for people who haven't heard of it, because the interface between the Tulku system and, like, research and the kinds of similarities between those two, I find so interesting.
Yeah, they have their own way of research. Robert Thurman, I think, says that something to the effect of either he or Alan Wallace or both of them that, you know, we focused on externals in terms of our research, and they focus on internals, which is, but that it, there's a system of checks and balances.
Yeah.
And empirical verification in the system, so it really has been a spiritual laboratory in a sense. It's not, I'm not saying that very clearly, but there's a particular methodology which could be called science, which is science.
Yeah.
In any of these practices.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also been ways that the system has been abused or corrupted or whatever, but, like, still the very fact that it exists to me is just, like, mind-blowing, especially if you actually believe in literal reincarnation.
I sent you an email today.
Yeah.
University of Wisconsin, the Center for Healthy Minds, which is as like mainstream as you can get, right, in terms of the academic.
Yeah.
They just did research on the Thutom, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. I
and
saw
the,
that. That's so cool.
The first empirical study. And I don't know. I didn't read the study
yeah.
in depth. But to me, that's one more indication that the sort of normal society is opening up to things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I feel like we've swung in such a physicalist direction. It just feels like we're swinging back now, you know? Like you're saying, you know, all this, like, magic that, excuse me, comes through in, like, the sort of folk traditions. You can't squish this stuff out of people, you know? And like, with all the tools we have at our disposal now, like, with science and research and all that kind of stuff, like, to take them and use them to explore these topics, you know, investigating reincarnation or Thutom or, like, you know, mediumship, like, it just feels like we're at this moment when there's this fizz of, like, new exciting stuff going on. It's really cool.
Yeah, I agree. It is cool.
Thanks for listening all the way to the end. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it or leave a rating or review. May you and all beings be well.